This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined again by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got three sponsors for the show, the first being EasyWatch.com, who have over 30 years of experience in the security camera systems industry. In addition to helping businesses, EasyWatch specializes in security camera systems for schools. The show is also brought to you by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work, and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, grades, and more. And finally, Tap Typing teaches students to type on the iPad. It has a structured curriculum with lessons ranging from beginner to advanced, typing tests for gauging improvement, and in addition to the built-in virtual keyboard and many third-party keyboards, has support for all types of external keyboards and keyboard cases. I'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, good evening.
Hello.
Long time no chat. Yep.
Yeah. So just a little backstory to everybody that may care. We had a show last week, pretty much recorded, and like we have, Fraser and I have both like had some changes with our like recording setup. So I switched from recording in GarageBand and into Logic. And like we also run, I also run Call Recorder, which is a Skype plugin that records both sides of the call as like a backup. And correct me if I'm wrong, you're using Soundflower and then you're funneling it into Adobe Audition, correct?
That's correct. So I was using that to split out the left and right channels of Skype and recording my microphone in one track and your microphone in the other track. So I was doing a double recording, you were doing a double recording, and somehow, even having that amount of redundancy, we still managed to not have a complete show recorded at the end of the night.
So I would, yours is El Capitan Bugs, we assume. And see, what has happened the past two shows to me is somewhere, and I'm running El Capitan too, so it could, I'm going to blame Logic, but it could not be Logic's fault. My Mac has hard froze. And, you know, obviously I would rather Logic just crash than hard freeze, but my Mac is hard froze. And so like the call recorder file was corrupt. And so I'm not using Logic this week. We're just using Call Recorder, and I'm recording into QuickTime. So praying that, and then because you're on a different computer, so we
Yes, I've reconfigured everything. I'm also using Audio Hijack as well tonight to try and capture another version of the audio as well. So we should be safe tonight, I hope.
Yeah, I use Audio Hijack quite a lot this week. Actually, I went to a concert last week in Nashville. And I there was the concert video was released on Tidal, like the Jay-Z type Spotify service, and it was Need to Breathe, great band. So I use Audio Hijack to make my own bootleg recording of the CD.
Awesome,
good times. It's a good app for that. I don't feel guilty about it because I would buy it if it was out, and I've spent way a lot of money with them over the years. So I feel like that's like, you know, when you're a fan of an artist, if you don't have an unauthorized bootleg of a concert video, then you're not really a fan.
Yeah, that's the true mark, isn't it?
So so we had, I thought, a great show recorded last week. I was ashamed that we lost. So we're going to re-record that, and hopefully it won't sound terrible and sound like we've done this already. But before we get started, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at EasyWatch.com. Now, EasyWatch.com has over 30 years' experience in the security camera systems industry. In addition to helping businesses, EasyWatch specializes in security camera systems for schools. I can tell you, as a school, you cannot invest enough money into your security cameras and your security systems. Many security camera systems are not sufficient, like ours wasn't, and EasyWatch values the quality of their products and their customers above all else, meaning they won't sell it if it doesn't meet their standards. EasyWatch tests every system extensively and offers lifetime technical support. During the past 15 years, over 100,000 EasyWatch security systems have been successfully installed, and over 60% of their sales come from repeat customers, which they believe is the greatest endorsement of the quality of their product and the excellent customer service you'll receive from them. Solutions for schools and school systems are more important than ever, and EasyWatch has a great deal for you with a custom system. And if you go to this link, easywatch.com/out of school, that's the letter EZWatch.com/out of school, you'll get a custom quote and 17% off of that quote. So thanks to EasyWatch.com for sponsoring the show. I guess I probably should explain how the whole stolen iPad thing at our school went down.
Oh, yeah.
The kids, of course we got the iPads back. The kids were arrested. And that's kind of how it happened. We took us about a month to get the iPads back. All I'll say is the police have very different tools for extracting data than you and I have.
Given the story I'm about to tell, I'm really going to wish I had that tool as well.
Yeah, they pulled a lot of data from iPads that, from my vantage point seemed to be wiped clean. And so, yeah, using that with some low-tech detective work, and props to the Chattanooga Police Department. Like, obviously, it would have been very easy for them to give up on the case because we had the iPads back, but they did not. And, yeah, my hope with this all is, obviously, I'm not hoping kids go to jail forever for something like this. You just hope that this scares them straight.
Mm. Do you have a death penalty in your state?
I don't know.
I don't think you get a death penalty for stealing iPads. But anyway.
No. And, you know, again, it's one of those things I tried to look at. This was my kid, and he was just going through a phase or something. It's like, what? Maybe this is something that can help those kids get back on the right path in society. So, yeah. All kind of ended well. And the cool thing is it, like, netted a lot of positive PR for the school. Mm-hmm. And we did a massive, massive upgrade to our fire system this year. And so along with that, unfortunately, I couldn't use EasyWatch.com because I don't have any say over our vendor for that. Like, that's our operations folks. They have their own local vendors for some of that stuff. And it did a big upgrade to our access control, and we added some – we're in the process of adding cameras. But, yeah, we did a big fire system upgrade. We have an older building that was grandfathered in on a lot of fire codes, but we retroactively brought ourselves up to current code, you know, without being told from the fire marshal. It was just one of those things. We felt like it was the right thing to invest in our building, which is what you have to do when you have an old building. You've got to continually invest in it. We've spent millions of dollars over the past, I would say, 5 years. Not millions. I'd probably say hundreds of thousands of dollars investing back into our building. Because if you don't do that, it's like your house. If you don't continually invest in your building, just as the same with technology, then it falls apart and you have to do a bunch of stuff right at once.
And always when you don't want to as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Always.
It's never a good time. So, check out EasyWatch.com if you're looking for an upgrade. Well, I guess before we get started, let's, you know, you and I both have, we've both started school. So let's recap the first few days of school.
Okay. How was it for you?
First day of school here was fantastic. Of course, one of the things that being in elementary school, we really have three first days of school because a good portion of our school does what's called phase in, where basically a third of the class comes on Wednesday, a third comes on Thursday, and then the other third comes on Friday. It helps the younger kids kind of get adjusted.
Okay.
We do that in K-3, K-4, and K-5. Mm-hmm. And then on Monday, the whole school will be there. So we've done first day of school three times, and it's gone great. We've kind of got that plane in the air. And we had a new addition to our maintenance department. We have our maintenance guy is actually 80, and he's incredible. So obviously he's 80, and so he's getting closer to retirement. So we've hired a new guy that's coming along, kind of like doing an apprenticeship with him. He's full time, but we're bringing him on before we need him, just so he can understand everything and how everything works. And I told him, I said, these past 2 weeks would be the busiest of the year because once the kids are back in, it just like kind of everything slows down because the focus is on the kids. And so teachers aren't doing a lot of things in the room. They're not, you know, they're slammed from 8 until 3:30, and then you'll get some work after that. But so it's really slowed down. But yeah, everything's great so far. So we're off and running.
Good. Yep. Today, as of the recording, was our first day of school. One of the biggest school roles we've had. We hit triple figures, 100 pupils started on the first day, which is awesome for us. Really happy about that. And also, obviously, our exam results came through, 100% pass rate, which is awesome. Not very easy to do that in any school. Of course, our sample size is small, granted, but very, very happy with that. And my day was basically entirely a queue of niggling small problems that lined up for me. Things like the headphones don't sound right on my iPad, blah, 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 blah. And then one girl came along and she's like, Mr. Spears, my iPad just crashed. And she handed me this iPad, which honestly looked like it was having a seizure. It was pixelated on the screen, flashing alternate blue on the desktop picture, just completely fritzed out. And I'm guessing the logic board just ate itself. But then, so that led me into a whole unedifying story of help with Apple support. And what happened was I was basically trying to, the scenario we have is that all of our devices are supervised. And our senior students, as this girl was, they use an individual Apple ID and they back their data up to iCloud. So what I was looking for was the ability to restore her iPad to her iCloud backup to a new supervised iPad and still have it supervised. And try as I might, I couldn't quite get this right. And every time this happens, it's always a complete hassle because there's no documented procedure for this on the Apple website. So eventually, in frustration, I phoned up Apple and I said, put me through to enterprise support. I want to talk to somebody about Apple Configurator. And because I was speaking to an automated voice system rather than a human being on the phone, the Apple voice system couldn't detect Apple Configurator as an actual product that Apple sold. So they were like, are you saying computer? I'm like, no, Configurator. So eventually, I got through to enterprise support. And I explained what I've just explained to you. And the guy helpfully said, yeah, that's not supported. You could try it in one computer, but it's just kind of up to you whether or not that works. Is that okay? And I said, no, that's not really okay, but that seems to be all you've got. So I left that. And I sat sort of fuming for about half an hour, trying to figure out what to do, sending out some angry tweets just to calm myself down. And then I decided, what the hell? I went and looked up the phone number for Apple US Enterprise Support, and I phoned them up. I said, look, I'm phoning from the UK, a little bit desperate here. I need you to tell me what the actual procedure is for this thing that I want to do. And I explained the whole situation to them again. And instead of giving the European shrug and just putting the phone down, they got on a screen sharing session with me, called in a senior technician guy to talk to me on the phone, emailed me a bunch of documents, blah, blah, blah. And eventually we got the situation resolved. So there's a little comparison of my day with phoning Apple Europe and Apple US support. But I'm going to give you, Bradley, I'm going to give you the secret to this. Okay. This is like an Indiana Jones bursting at the temple, stealing the idol. This is the most precious secret in iPad deployment. And what you do is, this has changed since iOS 6 and 7, but basically now with iOS 8, with a supervised device, the supervision profile is now stored as part of the iCloud backup. So the procedure that I was going through was my procedure from previous OSs, which was supervise the new device, restore the backup, refresh it in Apple Configurator, and the supervision would persist. And the problem I was having was that the supervision would just be wiped every time. But the trick now is, because the supervision profile is in the backup, you have to start with an unsupervised device, restore the backup, and then connect it to Apple Configurator. At this point, Configurator thinks that the device is not supervised, so it puts it into the Prepare tab. But if you click Prepare, it will reconnect its supervision profile, and it will not erase the device, even if you have Erase Before Installing turned on. And with that, the device would be reconnected with Configurator, and that was us up and running again. So that was my after school today, was that those two different phone calls.
I have been thoroughly impressed with Apple Enterprise Support when dealing with Configurator issues. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a wise decision that they would put Configurator under Enterprise Support and not under AppleCare. Yeah. Not that the AppleCare folks aren't knowledgeable, but they're dealing with a single person's like iCloud backup. Mm-hmm. Is not that to demean that, but that is drastically different than dealing with a fleet of iPads.
Yeah.
And the speed at which you need things done, and the fact that they'll just like remote in, it's like, oh, let's fix this. I mean, now the trick is you have to have one device under warranty to call them. So that's like the trick. This is trick two. You get trick one. This is trick two. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what device it is. You just need a serial number of any kind that's under warranty. You got an iPhone that's under warranty, just give them that serial number. Say that's either the Mac or any device you connected to that, apparently, it's supposed to just have, you know, to be able to get support. So I just always give them my iPhone because it's usually under warranty, and they help. I think it's like one of those like bureaucracy things for them to help you. You know, they have to like click, you know, add something in. But Apple Enterprise Support has always been helpful with Configurator, and how it works now is how it should work. You just weren't used to that.
Yeah, I was used to obscure workarounds. There used to be a trick to it where you had to unplug the iPad at one point in the backup and restore, and then plug it in again at another point. And if you missed either of those two points, the whole thing wouldn't work.
It's like jailbreaking.
Yeah. It's like, hold this down for 10 seconds, stand on your head, and then boom, done. So anyway, that is the procedure. I'm going to try and blog that quite soon, just so that I can find it on the web the next time I look for it. But that was my day with Apple Support.
Yeah, so everything's, like I said, everything's rolling here. I have not moved to device, obviously it's because it's not out yet, to installing apps over the air through the Casper suite. So I'm actually adding some apps as we speak. It's running over there on the side back in my place where I record my office. And this 8.4.1 update right when school started really is killing me, because I forgot that I had turned on Always Update. Yep. And it, so it's to add one app, I'm having to go through iOS 8.4.1. But it, we were talking before the show, I need to turn that off. But the problem is if I turn that off, I will never update because I will never want to do that.
Yeah, it's so always too much time.
Yeah, it's like there's never a good time to do that. So I'm just like forcing myself to update to it because I did that last year. Like I got behind on updates because there was like a never a good time to do that. And so, yeah, it's nice, but you know, living the dream. So moving on, I have a new toy at home I am playing with. If you saw a tweet I had a few weeks ago, it is a Samsung tablet. And it's for a project, which I cannot disclose at the moment, that I will later. It's a testing device. And so it's not like I would say the best Android device on the market or the one I would buy if it was for like personal use. But it is a device, and it's the first time I've spent more than like 5 minutes with an Android device, like where I've actually gone through the process of setting it up and like using it for hours on end like I would an iPad or an iPhone. And so just had some thoughts that I wanted to run through, some good, some bad, some just good info. First thing is on the setup. So again, this is not a Nexus device, so it's like a get the Samsung stuff on top of it. So like when I'm setting it up, it walks me through all the Google stuff. Then it like wants me to set up a Samsung account, which seems to do a lot of the same things the Google account would, like backup and restore. And so to me, it feels a lot like it's setting up a Dell computer where you have all this stuff from Microsoft. Then Dell comes in and says, look, we get this other suite of tools, which is even better, that we're going to do a pop-up of every other day until you either ignore it or do it. And so that's the only thing that like was perplexing to me on the setup where, you know, when you're setting up an iOS device, because by the nature of it, it's all in one ecosystem, you don't have those like competing signals. You know, where I, as a tech person, know the difference between storing my data with Google and then my Google Play account versus like setting up an entirely different Samsung device. Because, you know, like if I, you know, let's say someone just sets it up with the Samsung thing and then they get like an HTC tablet, they can't restore from that, and they don't understand why.
Yeah, yep. It was always confusing to me with Android devices why there was like two of everything. You know, there's two browsers and two email clients, or sometimes three. I've seen from time to time, and I guess that's what it is. It's your core OS, and then it's your over the top stuff from the vendor as well.
Yeah, if I was buying one, it would have to be a Nexus device. Of course, the tablet I have is not Retina, and gosh, it is crazy how quickly going back to a non-Retina tablet like kills you. It's terrible. It's a first world problem, but it's terrible. One of the things I realized as I was setting this up is, especially now that I'm using Wunderlist for my task management /GTD system, how so many of my apps are cross-platform. Really, the only thing that I depend on daily that isn't on there is iMessage. And that kind of led me through thinking through my head about like what is an app now. You know, so many of the apps I use are not even like syncing via iCloud. They're syncing via their own platform, whether it be like an Evernote, a Dropbox, a Google Drive, a Day One. Which I don't even think they have that for Android, but you know, you see what I'm saying, like you know, a Wunderlist. Like these are apps that are simply talking to cloud services, and that is great as a user. But the fact that I can log into an Android device and have like pretty much all of my apps is terrible for Apple.
Yeah, I mean, you remember I used to describe the smartphone as like a remote control for the cloud. And I think that's increasingly what you're seeing is, you know, whoever owns these platforms really owns the power. And I suppose that the risk for Apple always is to be turned into dumb glass, you know, that there is no difference between an iPhone and an Android phone. And I think one of the reasons why you see Apple investing so much in the camera and the photos infrastructure is because that is one thing that still, I believe, really strongly sets the iPhone apart from Android phones in particular, is the quality of the camera and the software that goes around it.
Yeah, I've read that as well. Like even on the high-end Android phones that have similar camera specs, that there's so much that the iPhone does in software to make the camera better. And that's my main camera. So again, the one thing that killed me is no iMessage. There's some ways to set up your iCloud calendars and contacts. I didn't do those because I didn't want to buy another app. I did set up my iCloud Mail on it because that's how I use my personal mail. Mm-hmm. And it worked fine in like the general IMAP email client. The only thing I didn't like was it like made a new sent folder, made a new trash folder. And yeah. I can't handle stuff like that. Like just use the ones I already have. But yeah, other than that, like, you know, the actual apps, like everything seemed to work okay. Like mm-hmm. I had my Kindle. You know, that's one of the reasons I'm glad I really started moving away from iBooks and onto Kindle. Because again, I love Apple today, but I don't want my entire book library to be tied up into something that is not a platform that is tied to just one OS. Mm-hmm. And you almost wonder, is it better for, should Apple make iBooks for Android in same way they're making Apple Music for Android?
That's a good question. I think that I guess maybe books just aren't quite as much of a strategic priority for Apple. And I think also with the ebook antitrust case, I'm not sure that they want to be seen to be making too many moves in the book department at the moment.
Yeah, that's true. And so one of the apps that really was a standout to me on Android was 1Password. Mm-hmm. And it, particularly because of the keyboard. I like keyboards okay on iOS, like the third party. They're not as good as the built-in one, and that's not any fault of any app developer, but that's just it's just the way it is. The 1Password keyboard on Android, I use it full-time. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that because the standard Android keyboard isn't that good that a third party can do just as good a job?
I don't think so. I think it's because their keyboards, and it may just because of the technology has been there longer for third-party mm-hmm. keyboards within the OS, and they feel more native. Where mm-hmm. when you're using a third-party keyboard on iOS, you can tell it's a third-party keyboard.
Yeah. I think the method of switching between them in iOS just breaks the illusion so completely. You know, it's like, oh, the keyboard went away, but the space is still there, and now seconds later, here's another keyboard, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, it really, really easy to log into apps because, like, it's almost like when you're on iOS and you download an app, you go into 1Password and you copy your app password. Then you go in there and you find out it supports 1Password. Mm-hmm. You know, you're pleasantly surprised. But that's something that app developers have to build in. Or on Android, 1Password just, you know, because it's the keyboard, it can log you into any of your apps.
So yeah, it's a nice, again,
nice little feature. What else? Having the hardware back button, I hate it, particularly like when you're in like a different, like if you're in portrait versus landscape, you know, landscape, it's like on a weird spot. Mm-hmm. And I've really started to get accustomed to the, not only like the swipe on iOS to go back, but the new back button in iOS 9.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's going to be a really nice feature when it ships, I think, just to be able to go back to the thing that you were at before. But the point being that on iOS 9, it's on the screen. So it's kind of another software button, whereas this difference between the one button's in hardware and the rest are in software.
Yeah, I get an email. Whenever a parent updates their RenWeb information, I get an email basically going there to improve it, making sure they've formatted the data correctly. And I get, mm-hmm. I'll get four or five emails right at a time because the different – there's an email for grandparents. There's an email for medical stuff. And so I'll have to click on a link in the email, click approve. And now, and before I would have to like double tap, then go back to mail. Now I can just hit the back button to go right back to mail. Works fantastic.
Awesome.
So next thing, I guess I want to talk a little bit more about the apps. You know, I mentioned that all the apps were there. And this may, and I don't have any way to, I guess, quantifiably measure this. I just did not feel like they were as polished. And that part of that may be because I was on a non-Retina device and it's playing tricks with my mind. But I just didn't feel like things were like this detailed in the app. So like the Evernote app was, it was fine, but I did not like it near as well as the iPad version of Evernote.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know, and I don't know why. So do you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, I don't know. Did they feel just like phone apps? Or is that what...
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, most of the apps felt like they weren't reimagined for the tablet, but that's mm-hmm. probably the way iOS is going, you know, going forward with universal, or not universal, but auto layout.
Yeah. I wonder if it's just kind of, there's a limitation to responsive design, but, you know, how much response can you make, you know? You see it if you've got a really large display on the desktop and you've got a quote-unquote responsive website, It responds down fine to get onto phones, but it doesn't respond up the way to us beyond a certain size. You know, and you end up with big white bars, usually full of adverts down either side, you know. So maybe that's just the way of the future, you know. But like I said, we said to you before, Bradley, the idea on iOS 7 and 8, I guess, is that Apple talks about deference to your content. And what they mean by that is that like the amount of Chrome that's available versus the amount of content that's available should be very minimal. So if you look at Safari, for example, once you scroll up in that browser, essentially almost the entire screen is full of web content, and you've got a tiny sliver of thing that just tells you what domain you're on up at the top. And I think more and more, as we go further along that line, design of the app becomes such a minimal thing compared to just putting your content big and front and center.
Yeah, that's and that, Chris, that goes back to like discussions we have, what is the future of the tablet? Is it is it a big phone without a cellular contract if you have the Wi-Fi only one? I mean, the popular app Paper by 53, they make the great little pen. They just announced it's coming to the iPhone, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing for the platform, but again, that was a iPad only app.
Yeah, yeah, and so many have gone that way as well.
Yeah, and so all of their thinking going forward has to be about how does this work on the tablet and on the phone. So they have to design for all the way down to the 5C and all the way up to the 12-inch coming iPad.
I really hope that we'll see with iOS 9, I think you're starting to see the iPad is being allowed to diverge from the phone. I mean, basically, you know as well as I do that basically in the era iOS 6 and 7 and 8, the phone and the iPad have been the same thing. And really, it's been whatever the phone needs, and then the iPad just keeps up for the ride. Whereas with iOS 9, you're now starting to see, for the first time really since early days of iOS, specific UI just for the iPad. And that was, you know, back in the day when we had like popovers and things. Those were only on the iPad at first, and then eventually came to the bigger phones. And I will be interested to see the extent to which things like, you know, two-up apps and picture-in-picture and things, these iPad-specific features, drive the iPad further towards the Mac. It's always been my kind of complaint about Apple's stewardship of the iPad is that it hasn't really been allowed so far to really challenge the Mac as a computer for the majority of Apple's customers. You know, it's done that kind of low-end disruption thing where the least demanding 25% of users, you know, school children, pensioners, people like that, are perfectly happy with an iPad. That can be their only computer. But I would be very interested to see if we can get to a point where, you know, maybe not people like you and me, that might be pushing it a little far, but, you know, serious people who have serious business workflows could actually seriously think about iPad as their only computer and still interoperate fully with the rest of the world. I mean, you know, people like our pal Federico Vitici, you know, he uses his iPad basically as his main computer, but he lives in a world where he gets to basically define all his workflows for himself without reference to any other external body. Whereas you and I deal with, you know, educational agencies and suppliers and things like that. And if I go onto the exam board website and I download a zip file full of Word documents and I've got to somehow turn them into printed paper, that's easy on my Mac. But it's not super easy on my iPad. It can be done, and I could do it. But the problem is that bulk of people in the middle, that early majority, late majority adopters, it's way too complicated a process for them to do. So, and those things need to get smoother as well. I can see it coming. I had an interesting situation. I was doing in-service training and I was doing some advanced keynote stuff for the teachers. And one of my colleagues asked me, he said, if I've got a video at home, can I put it in my Google Drive and then put it into Keynote from my iPad? And I was like, oh man, that's a really hard question because the answer is going to be very complicated here. And in fact, the answer was dead easy, which was that inserting video and photos in Keynote now supports document provider extensions, right? So I said, okay, just tap on the plus button, tap on photos, tap on insert from, and then it popped up and it said Google Drive. Tap on your Google Drive, find your video in Google Drive, straight into your Keynote. And that there's glimmers of that kind of thing starting to happen that if you just kind of rethink it. And I think almost I'm struggling to unlearn the ways in which I've learned to use iOS. And you referred to that, Bradley, as well, about you know, how you normally work with one password and then you get a keyboard that can do it all for you. I think I also need to unlearn some of the things that I have learned and kind of things that I assume that are hard in iOS. And I think in iOS 9, that specifically is going to be a major point of relearning for a lot of people. Because many, many people that I know, both students and staff, who have been iOS four, five, six, seven, eight users, when they come to nine, they're going to have to relearn quite a few things. And I think that will be a valuable thing for people to do, but it will be interesting to see how many people actually kind of make that jump and do it. Maybe it'll be the new users.
Yeah, that's true. You go from a world thinking where that can be done, but it's complicated, to a world where like, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
And I think that if we look back, those document provider extensions are pretty useful going forward because you can pick your own cloud.
Yeah, they're really starting to mature nicely. When they first came out, they were flaky and they were confusing to use. But more and more I'm seeing, the big four, the Dropbox, OneDrive, Google Drive, and iCloud Drive are all starting to work really nicely together. And all through this document provider extension API. So it's something that's really coming together. And I think people who kind of go for that cloud first approach to their data are really going to be in a much better position going forward than people who have still got a whole bulk of files on their Mac that they don't sync anywhere.
So before we move on, let's thank our second sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Tap Typing. They're back with us again this year. They usually come and sponsor the show for a few weeks around the start of school. Now, if you are looking for a typing app for the iPad, a typing training app for the iPad, this is what you want to use. I own 81 licenses of this. Now, it has a structured curriculum with lessons ranging from beginner to advanced, a typing test for gauging improvement. In addition to the built-in virtual keyboard and many third-party keyboards, has support for all types of external keyboards and keyboard cases. Tap Typing has many educator-focused features as well. It's appropriate for all ages and supports multiple user profiles and a single install of the app. Additionally, Tap Typing sends no personal data to the cloud, so there's no student privacy issues. After just 3 sessions in Tap Typing, beginners increase their typing speed by over 60% on average. This minimal time investment yields a permanent boost to productivity and saves one of the most painful aspects of the iPad user experience, typing. Again, this is the typing training app for the iPad. Very, very inexpensive. I think there are 2 versions on the App Store. There's a one with in-app purchase, and then there's one with, it's kind of like the school edition as well, that has all of everything unlocked. And I love the developers are doing that. I bought an app today that had that. If you want to learn more about Tap Typing, go to gettaptyping.com. It's gettaptyping.com. Thanks to them for sponsoring the show this week.
Okay, so what's next?
Red Web 1. Mm-hmm. I've talked a lot today, but that's okay. So we've talked a lot about RenWeb, our student information system of choice. I've ranted on it many, many times. Love, hate relationship. Sometimes more hate.
I think it was more of a hate relationship most of the time.
Hate until the bill comes and it's a good price.
Yeah.
So they have a new, basically, platform called RenWeb 1, which is like one platform for all your devices. It's HTML5 based mostly. Now, a couple of years ago, they launched this thing called RenWeb Portal, which was a Silverlight-based version of their Windows-based desktop app. So they have the Windows-based desktop app, then FacultyWeb, which is a web-based app for teachers, only works in Firefox. And RenWeb Portal was a Silverlight version of that was meant to kind of replace it all, and they were adding pieces over time. Well, the problem was Silverlight got end-of-life, and I hate web plugins. So they started from scratch, and they built this new thing that completely replaces the desktop app, except for a few things in there still require Silverlight. But they've said like what we're working on now is getting rid of all Silverlight in our app. And I love to hear things like that from developers when they say, "Hey, we're making this plugin free." I hate web plugins; they're a security nightmare and they're an administration nightmare, especially apps like Silverlight and Flash, which are kind of complicated to upgrade. They said, look, hey, this is mature enough that you can ditch everything you're using and use this. And so I decided to. I deleted my 30-gigabyte Windows VM, and I went all in on it. I told myself I'm never going to learn it unless I force myself to use it. Found a few bugs along the way. They've been fixed very quickly by them, things were not working. Big fan of it so far. I have not moved any of our teachers over to it just because it launched like the first day of in-service, which, not the best day.
Not a good day to move teachers onto something else.
No, especially because I had barely used it. Yeah. I would rather have them launched it like in April, but it is what it is. They're continuing to support their old versions throughout the next school year, so that's great. So I basically told our teachers, hey, use this. Here's your old one today. You can use that. Here's how you get to the new ones. The same data, same login. If you want to use it, that's great too. Try it out. Let me know what you think. But what I'll probably do is around Christmas time, start trying to nudge people on it more and more. And then certainly next year, that'll be what we use. Because I'll have to retrain our office staff on it. And then our teachers will have to start using it as well. But yeah, I'm a big fan so far. Enjoying the extra 30 gigabytes of space on my Mac.
Okay. Good stuff.
Yes. Yep. Next thing is another app that we rolled out school-wide this year, which kind of corny, but I like it. It's called Spelling City. We had some teachers that have been using this in years past, and I had just been paying for their premium accounts out of my budget, but it made sense to kind of pull those all into one school account, and we got a nice price break. But really, really big fan for it for your spelling lessons, and probably I don't think they do spelling in middle school and high school. I think that's just like an elementary thing. But have a great iPad app, works on the web as well, supports testing. So teachers can assign a test and you can set the time period the test can be taken and does your grading for you. Pretty easy to upload all of our students. We created a CSV file and the folks at Spelling City, very, very easy to work with them getting that installed. I can manage students and drop them into teachers' buckets and we can copy the list between teachers. It does support Google single sign-on, so like if you're a Google App school and your students have Google logins, they can use that as well. But again, big fans of Spelling City so far.
Good. So I thought Bradley would wrap up. I was just going to tell you some of the things I've been up to over the summer.
Yeah, we'll do our final sponsor. Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can easily and quickly collect and review student work on their iPads and then provide feedback directly on the documents through rich annotation features such as the pen tool and text tool and voice notes. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of iPad apps or by using Shobi's built-in tools. New to Shobi this year is a new gradebook feature for Shobi Pro, which allows teachers to easily add, review, and export student grades. More great features like student portfolios and parent access will be coming this fall. Now, Shobi Basic is 100% free, and individual teachers listening to the show can get started today. And if they want to sign up for Shobi Pro, you can get 30% off if you purchase it annually. So start your paperless classroom today by downloading Shobi in the App Store or visiting Shobi.com, Shobie.com. So thanks to Shobi for sponsoring the show this week. You know, it's funny that Shobi, their kind of new strategy is they're focusing on the teachers and they'll let the teachers pitch it to the IT folks. And that's the same way Spelling City worked. If teachers can vouch for the platform already, I'm a fan of it. It's better than me going and finding something and then pushing it on to them.
Yeah, it's always a much better opportunity for adoption that way, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. So, good stuff.
Cool. So I was busy over the summer, even in the weeks when we weren't recording. And mainly what I've been doing, Bradley, is I have been writing new courses for students. And one of the things, just the kind of colophon of the whole thing, is that I have been back in love with Omni Outliner, which is an outlining app which I used many years ago when I was a student and loved it back then and kind of stopped using for a very long time and have recently gotten back into it. And it is, I don't know why I ever left. It's so great. And what it does is it basically lets you write rows of data, but indent them under other rows and group them and fold them and everything like that. So when you're writing something kind of long and complex, like a course, they could have individual rows, which are lessons. And then underneath that, I've got individual rows, which are paragraphs in the lesson and assignment rows and so on. And it has a really, really powerful styling system. So you can say all the rows at this level get this style, all the rows at that level get another style. And that lets you kind of visually see by color and by style whether or not your structure is the same all the way through or whether you've got anomalous rows indented or outdented or so on. So that's been really great. That's omnigroup.com, in case Andy wants to check that out. They've got the coolest thing as well is they've now got a version for iPad and iPhone, where previously it was been a Mac app for many years before that. So that's another one of those apps that was Mac only, came to iPad, and now it's on the phone. So that's interesting too. But what I've done is I've written two courses. One is we changed our computer programming language from Ruby to Python. And that was a decision that we made partly because the tools that we were using to program in Ruby were taken away from us by AppReview. So we were using an app called Textastic, which was able to save files to an SFTP server and upload and download and so on. And that got uprated to 17 plus, so we couldn't use it anymore. But the bigger reason was that we wanted to, I wanted to change the way we taught programming. And I also wanted to adopt Python because it seemed, that seems to be in schools who are not sticking with Visual Basic, which is, you know, still a big bulk of schools, schools that are not still teaching VB. It seems that most people are switching to Python. So I thought we would try and line up with that a little bit more as well. But the main reason I wanted to do it was because, like I said, I wanted to change the way we taught programming. And in previous times, you know, in the old exam courses in Scotland, you would sort of teach programming this way. You would start with variables, and then you would do mathematics and string manipulation, textual input and output, selection, if statements and branch statements like that, and then iteration, which is, you know, for loops and while loops and so on. And that would kind of be your first exam level learning in computer science, was that much. And then in the, if you pass that exam, you'd go on to what we call the higher course, and you would, there you would learn how to write functions. And amongst other things as well, arrays and different things. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to sort of reverse the way that we taught that, because I wanted to bring in functions first. And the reason I wanted to do that was because I wanted to adopt what's called test-first programming as a way to teach computer programming. And test-first programming is when you write a test for your code, and then you write the code to pass the test. And you obviously start with a test that fails, and then as you write the code, the test begins to pass in more cases, and then eventually all the test cases should pass. And I wanted to do that first, because what I've been looking for a long time was a way to, you know, when you teach kids how to program, they write the program all in one go, and then they test it, and it doesn't work, and they spend, you know, 40% of the time writing the program and 60% of the time debugging the program that they wrote and didn't understand. So what I wanted to do was to use unit testing, this test-first approach, to try and, in the first early stages of the course, what I do is I provide the tests and the pupils have to write the code that passes the test. But every time they run the program, they're running the tests and they're getting feedback on whether their program is right or wrong all the way through it. So I'm really hoping that that approach is going to be very effective for beginning programmers. I'm quite optimistic about it, and I will report back at the end of the year and let you know how it goes.
Yeah, that's, you know, those are always like fun. You know, you have those like kind of change of curriculum type years where, mm-hmm. you know, next summer you're going to be like, burn it all down and start over again. But yeah. Like, but it'll be one of those where you burn it down to like have the phoenix rise from the ashes. Like, you'll know, you know, what doesn't work and what works. The thing that's really perplexing to me with Textastic is, you know, it's very frustrating when you have an app that you want to use, but mm-hmm. you still want to keep out 17 plus apps. I would love to be able to have a way to whitelist an app on the apps on like in your Casper suite,
yeah,
to be say, okay, this is the restriction except for this app.
Yeah. Or these are the ones that are allowed except for this app. So there are some apps that are rated below your threshold that you still don't want in. Snapchat is a good example, which is rated, I think, 12 plus or maybe even less than that. Or was, at least the last time I looked at it. And to be able to blacklist certain apps as well, I think would be very powerful.
I agree with that.
Of course, I should mention we're using Pythonista, of course, which is one of the most incredible apps I have ever seen on iOS. I mean, it's right up there with, you know, OmniGraffle and Safari itself, and many other tools. I mean, it's the kind of development environment that Apple should be shipping with the OS to schools. It is unbelievable. My only regret is that I didn't do this sooner. Really, Pythonista is amazing. I've been dealing with a developer who is an excellent guy. He's been working with me on a couple of features that I hope are going to ship in the next version that will make it easier for students to write code and submit it back through iTunes U as a PDF, which I think is going to be excellent. And it's just been an absolute delight to work with that app. I'm really looking forward to giving it to the kids tomorrow.
Yeah, it's. I love situations like this where you have this fresh approach and you just mm-hmm. like, you hope the kids are excited about it as you are. And that's kind of one of those ways, you know, you're a teacher when you're really excited about something like that.
Yeah, you're more excited about it than the kids are. I can just see what's going to happen tomorrow. It's going to be like, oh, program. Yeah.
So yeah, school years ago, I mm-hmm. Had my first class on Friday. So by the time this show comes out, I will have had my first class. Hopefully that'll go well. We're doing a 4-class unit on digital citizenship to start the year. Got a clip book from Amazon on the Kindle by the, I think ISTE put it out. But it has some cool scenarios. It'll be a kind of a low-tech class, but it's a lot of thought-provoking stuff. And it's it's even things like, you know, why is it appropriate when you're like to walk and text, not do that? If you're in a restaurant, why is it not appropriate to talk loudly on the phone? And, you know, we laugh about those things, but like those are things like we grew up like knowing that because we got phones when we were already like out in public or out in the world. But kids today, that's just part of the, so part of their life. Like they kind of have to be taught those social skills around, you know, around technology.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, be a fun little unit.
One other thing Bradley's going to mention, I've also been working on a class based on a book called The Diffusion of Innovations by a guy called Everett Rogers. And this is the book where you get from which you get phrases like early adopter and laggard and things like that. And I think maybe we'll do a show or maybe even two shows based on that book, because I think it would be very interesting for people to read. It's basically a book about how technology or how ideas get adopted by more and more people in a social system. And it's highly relevant to, you know, a lot of the things that a lot of our listeners will be doing as well, like trying to get iPads or one-to-one programs adopted in your school. How do you bring along people to agree with this new innovation and adopt it? So one of the reason I'm doing that is because our curriculum has a statement where the kids are supposed to be able to make a judgment about the possibility of a technology coming into being or something like that. I'm blanking on the exact language, but this is the kind of way I'm going to do that, is to use this book as a lens to look at different technologies and how did they all get adopted over time. And it's got some great case studies in it as well about, it's not just technology, it's not digital technology all the time, although mobile phones are in there, for example, but it's also about things like innovations in farming, innovations in public health and different things like that as well. And why do some innovations get adopted? Why do some innovations get rejected? And who's kind of responsible on either side of that divide? So that might be the next couple of shows. I think it would be a really nice way to kind of roll into the term where people are thinking about talking to other people about new technology. How do you get Shobi adopted in your school? How do you get iTunes U up and running? Well, this is one way to look at that kind of thing.
Yeah, this is one of those. I was thinking about, you know, I should like read this book as well. Maybe we can do like a whole book club on over a few shows. Pulled up my Amazon app on my phone. Paperback, $26.54 US. How much do you think the Kindle version is?
I'm going to say 15.
$27.99. It's more.
Yay.
I mean, what is wrong with the world when the digital copy is more than the hardback or paperback?
Welcome to buying academic texts. Yeah.
Well, I can rent it for $13.
Yeah. If people want to read it and or begin, we could maybe start a look at that. Send us quick feedback on Twitter or through our feedback form at outofschool.net. If you think that would be a useful series, let us know. But I will do an introductory to the book next week and then we'll maybe take it from there. How about that?
Yeah, that'll work. You can find us on iTunes, itunes.com/outofschool. You can find me on the web at chambersdaily.com or Bradley Chambers on Twitter.
Okay, and I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.